The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
I woke up this morning with a smile on my face and a great big heart on for the whole human race. I love everybody and I want you to know. Got the word by the balls and I won't let it go. And I don't give a damn if they take me away. Cause I'm so fucking happy. He's so fucking happy. I'm so goddamn happy.
Today's secret melody is... Now, the next time you hear that on the show, call the station, hum it, and here's our answer to tell you how you're going to win.
You'll win nothing. Yes, you'll get absolutely nothing for repeating a secret melody. But keep trying if the phones are busy.
Maybe that's the melody.
Secure the template. Set the backside guide to appropriate lockset basket. The backside guide tabs include setting the jig. Possessing template. What the hell am I reading?
Shady.
I'm in a hurry.
Think you can handle it by yourself?
Tell it, I was raised up here. Mush! Mush!
I don't care where I'm going, just as long as I'm with you. Put it there, pal. Put it there.
You know, I saw Let's Face It.
Yes, and I saw Dixie, too.
Big picture, huh?
Put it there, pal. Put it there. This country's full of wolves, but you should make them laughing stocks. The girls are fond of blubber, and the igloos have no locks.
Oh, you wow, the lady Eskimos, they don't wear bobby socks.
You're so faithful and so fair. Hit me with your biscuit hook, ain't
it? Come up with some hot skin. You've got that something in your voice so right for selling cheese.
Put it there, pal. Put it there.
I think your jokes are great.
You?
Just that folks are hard to please.
Yeah.
Your hand, sir.
Put that back in the bowl.
Your face could make a fortune. Just your nose should make a lot.
I like the way you wear those gaudy colored shirts you got. The only time a rainbow ever covered up a pot.
We make a perfect pair. Put it there.
My colleague.
My crony.
My cohort.
My friend.
Companion.
Confederates.
Chums to the end.
Like meat and potatoes.
Or salt and tomatoes.
Boy, what a plan. Don't put it in the paper. Don't put it on the air. Don't put it on the shelf. Put it there.
Okay. attention closely to the next voice you hear. Art of Broadcasting, now once again now, Hoy, today, in any language, in many languages, brings you the chronicling of all time. Oshwood we, Usted, right here. My name is Frank Atoll, my man's name adorns the title of the show, Luck, Smarts, Guts, and Hearts. Laugh, chuckle, and learn. Here we go with another Chronicles Y2K Plus 13. Make holiday, put on your straw hat, your high-heeled sneakers. Helmets and face masks are not required. As we move along, neo-postmodernists, into the night. Wake up! It is night!
Kept from Hamlet to City from Othello and into every bordello.
I knew he would skip along there somewhere. It was into. Now I have to say it again anyway, because otherwise I would break the stream of what has happened here since 1973 when we started this show. That was even before the internet back then. From ice cap to ice cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello and into every bordello. That's how you say it. Clear and smooth. I'm sorry, I cannot pass the torch of this Cthulhu Chronicles over to you until you get that straight. So go study it and practice somewhere else, because we're moving right along here as the Y2K plus 13 moves along. I know. It's difficult. He walks away with a frown, his head down. Because you know why? Because you got to earn the spot. I earned it. He'll earn it. He can't just pass it on. Who do you think we are? John Gambling and John Gambling Jr.? He just passed it right on. Nobody even knew when John Gambling Jr. took over John Gambling Sr., the show. He just, and this is amazing too, because, you know, usually in life you have to audition. You'd have to have, in other words, there's not this kind of, what is that? This royalty, this passing on of, this bequeathing of airtime. Bequeathing legacy of airtime, but John Gambling Jr. did indeed take over when John Gambling Sr. Ended his run on WOR and many, many years ago. Those of you who are looking for any kind of radio history can go ahead and find that out. I don't know if Mr. Gambling Jr. is still alive, but he just took over the show, and I guess it just doesn't happen. You know what I'm saying? Chris Elliott did not take over for Bob Elliott, who was a member of Bob and Ray. Very famous, because there was no Ray at the time. Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding. Does anyone remember that? Write this down. My name is Frank. What? What's the question of one? What?
Which one is the most qualified?
Mr. Ray Cotolo is hanging out with us tonight because it's spring break everywhere across this great country of ours and the other countries, I believe. Although I believe that Easter is represented. Around the world you need to stop learning how to step on lines. You wait. Remember, what is it?
Timing
right? He's still learning, but we got it all together. And on this show, Y2K Plus 13, we are the last show of March here. We got through the Ides. It's the 28th. We had 7, 14, 21, 28. And on this show, we have happy to have Dr. Karen Wyatt back on the show. She's the author. Yeah, they say author. They don't say authoress anymore. They say actor for actresses. Writer is a writer, but they don't say authoress. Did they ever say authoress? I don't know. The author of What Really Matters, whatreallymattersbook.com, I think. Well, you could go to the, you could find the book anywhere, Amazon or any other jungle available out there that sells books. And you can go to cotolachronicles.blogspot.com and clip. I said clip. Listen to this. That's another word in digital technology, clip. I meant click upon the link, What Really Matters, and go buy the book. We endorse, encourage, and support the sale of What Really Matters by Dr. Karen Wyatt, who was here to promote the book when it came out a while back. And I said, would you be part of our panel when you can? And we can talk about the things that Dr. Karen Wyatt knows best in deal. And it turns out that for all the great education that Dr. Karen Wyatt did indeed endure, I say endure. Some people would say embrace. I say endure because in education, like when you talk about academic education, I'm ready to just bug out, you know. But she has spent a great deal of time with people who knew they were leaving this mortal shell, and has great things to say about dealing with that. Not just dealing with it if you take the place of those people, which one day you might, unless, you know, you don't know when it happens suddenly. We don't care about that. It's a very touchy subject, you know. But all of us have to deal with the fact that not only are we going to die, but the loved ones are going to die, and death is in the air. Death in the afternoon, as Mr. Hemingway called it. So even because they all knew, even certainly people like, I was going to say bulldozers, I meant bullfighters, know that's what death in the afternoon means, of course. Even they knew that this was a very, very dangerous life, and then you put yourself in harm's way. Many, many ways. I have a question in the audience here. What's the question from off there? Go ahead.
How many dead people does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Okay, so we have the humor death side of it. You know, when you're young, let me tell you something about what he just said, because I think it's important, and maybe we'll talk to the doctor about this too, because the amount of comedy that's involved in making yourself feel okay about it. And comedians always say one thing, and this is I forgot exactly who said this in the beginning, and I've said it, I'll say it again. They say dying is easy, comedy is hard. See, it's easy. That's a very famous, who told me that? I forget who told me that. It was a very famous comedian who told me that to my face. And Miami, you know, who?
Like dying is easy, but comedy is hard.
Yeah, I forgot who told me that right to my face. Dying is easy, comedy is hard. Dying is easy, comedy. Yes. So, and of course, we do joke and jest about the darkest, deepest things as a matter of relief. But we'll talk to the doctor about that and about how she personally handled a death close to her. This is, you know, a lot of people say, you know, I listen to your show, I get a lapse and this, that, and the other thing. But remember, edification is involved. You can learn things. And we do have some great guests, on our panel and in the way of this microphone and Skype and everywhere else. So stay with us for all that stuff, because we intend to continue through into spring and into summer, and a lot of great guests will be back. A lot of people you know who have been on, who will be on again, you know, as we move on, and some great announcements coming up about other... Hear that? That's holding the microphone. Why is it? It's because it's so loud. Wait, let me hold the microphone without the stand. They call it a stand. Let me hold the microphone without the stand. Because a lot of this stuff that's going on is going to be happening for you everywhere right here. We're going to have Dr. Wyatt on shortly. I know that Dr. Wyatt is already online and waiting for the call, and we will get to that shortly. A couple of things. First, the CartoloChronicles.blogspot.com. Thank you, everybody who has been out there buying books. And who has been, What was that? I did it without saying it. That's right. Replenishing your precious bodily fluids. Any doctor would tell you this is an important thing to do. And while you are here with us, you certainly need to do that. If you're talking to a friend or you're just listening to me, hopefully I qualify as a friend. You can, of course, and you should replenish your precious bodily fluids. That was my coffee. And I'm into my second cup as I fly through the evening here. What's coming up in April? That's what I was going to say. Kirk Brandow's coming up as soon as he puts some stuff together over there in the Qatar. No, he's not in Qatar. I always like to say that place because Qatar. He's in not Dubai. He's in the United Amid Erigans. I knew Amid Erigan. I knew him. He was a record producer. Did you ever see the movie Ray Charles? Aaron Emigad. I forgot his name now. Ahmed Emigad. I knew that guy. Yes, he worked upstairs when I was working at Great North American Music on Broadway. Ahmed Emigad. Well, you look it up. Look up. Get your Cotolo Chronicles notebook. You need it. Whether it's a bunch of papers that you put together, back of matchbooks. Who carries matchbooks anymore? I mean, people, I don't know who does that. Are there digital lighters and stuff like that? Or are there just, you know what? You know, be good. You should start your screenplay, Ray. Call it The Interrupters. I think that would be a good name for you. Let's sell some books and then come back shortly, okay?
In a world where reading is dying out, a new champion emerges. Wacky escapades. Parallel universes.
Hello, everyone. This is me, Frank Cotolo.
There's never a dull moment as Frank weaves a tale of a writer making you laugh, chuckle, and learn a bit about life. Pick up License to Scale by Frank Cotolo. Now on Amazon for your Kindle.
And that ain't all either, my friends. There's more. There's plenty more to read.
There's nothing un-American about Molotov Memoirs by Frank Cotolo, illustrated by T. Stephen Gessick. Why, this is Americana at its best. Literature, drama, conflict. It's everything I remember and things I think I remember through a storied life of history in show business, politics, and celebrated people's lives. It's me, Frank Cotolo, inviting you to buy Molotov Memoirs. Go to blurb.com and put in my name, Frank Cotolo, and get Molotov Memoirs. Buy a copy for your friends. Buy a copy for your lovers and your haters, everybody. This is America.
and it's now digital also. $3.99. I love those. You know, I love the way those Russians sang about freedom. They didn't sing about freedom. They sang about communism, which to them was freedom or something. I don't know. Whatever the case may be. There's two books. One of them, $2.99. They're both digital, and only one of them is a hard copy. It's still a celebrated book. Recently gotten great reviews in France, Molotov Memoirs. And yes, indeed, I am. I'll announce this right now. I am preparing more Molotov. I don't even know the title of my own book. More Molotov Memoirs. MMM, as it's going to be known as M3. More Molotov Memoirs. And it's the second one, but it's going to be known as M3.
It's MQ.
MQ? What is cubed?
M cubed.
Cubed is two?
Cubed is three.
Two. Well, we don't want two. We want M cubed of the three M's. Okay. Well, we can't call it 3M or the Scotch people will sue us. We can't somehow we'll get involved in that. Lord knows we can't afford a lawsuit right now. The Bard of Broadcasting, that's me. I am self-proclaimed that, but I do have a number of great things out there for sale. So please go and get them. And also, fourculture.com. I want you to get over to fourculture.com. These stories that appear at fourculture.com by me, Francatello are not appearing anywhere else but there. They won't be in books. Maybe in 10, 20 years they'll be in books if somebody decides after I'm dead and gone. Dead and gone. You like that one? How could you be dead in here? You're dead and gone. Oh, you're dead. And perhaps somebody will resurrect those things and put them on. I don't know. But right now, forculture.com. This is the cutting edge magazine of the internet. Digital, all digital. You flip the pages. You flip virtually. This is a virtual delight that you can have on your iPhone. I've seen them on iPhones, on iPads, and I've seen them on the screens of high density HDs. And if you have ADD and you have an HD screen, you're gonna have a lot of fun. And my stories appear in each magazine. Now, of course, there are plenty of other things to see, to read about. Cutting edge, I say that because this is not old fogey stuff. You don't have to take out the history books and read about this, any of the stuff that goes on in this magazine, because the things that are happening now. And so are the stories. So you got my books, you got my stories, you got ijdaily.blogspot.com, you've got CatoloChronicles.blogspot. Well, that just pretty much tells you where we're going times fast. Too many times quickly, I should say, not fast. And the other things, what else is going on? Twitter at Frank Catolo. Get on in there and follow me through the cyberspace world and all the millions and billions of people. Just remember Twitter. When you're tweeting, remember where you heard about it first. That's why I brought up Kurt Brandow. God only knows what cutting edge, speaking of cutting edge, things Kurt Brandow will be telling us when he decides to get up super early one day in the United Arab Emirates and talk to us once again. A longtime friend of this show, a longtime supporter, the digital slob himself, a longtime supporter of alternative broadcasting podcasts, and he had his own for a long time, called The Digital Slob. I think it was called The Digital Slob. Adventures of the Digital Slob. Son of Digital Slob, whatever. Kurt is a wonderful and a humorist. So man after my own heart. And he's not going to get it either because I don't have much of it left. We have Dr. Karen Wyatt, who we're going to call here now that we've done all our little work things, our stuff. And we're going to get to that. Do I have anything else to say about this going on? There were a number of things I was going to talk about, but I'm not talking about them now. I'm just going to see. It doesn't matter. Anytime I prepare and make notes, it doesn't matter. It just goes to proverbial hell because I can't go to real hell, but it goes to proverbial hell. I will have some other announcements. Why? You know, it's funny. I'm announcing that I will have announcements. That's stupid. That's just, I can be dumb and stupid too, you know, and I'm not afraid to say it, you know.
Would that be considered a paradox?
A paradox? No, paradox are Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare. See, and you know what's funny? Here I am, I know your audience. My son is 14. Are you 14 now? You're going to be 14?
Cricket.
Yeah, because he has to write these things down himself. He doesn't get it. You can't do references like that to people. A pair of docs, and they were doctors. I said paradox. I see. In any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, the author, certainly someone extremely talented in the world of academics, not like me, Dr. Karen Wyatt, are going to be here shortly. I think we've said everything we need to say. Even though I have cups of coffee being delivered to me by the dozens. Just look at this. Oh, look at that. And thank you very much. Mr. Smitty just dropped into the studio to sit down. And he's in from any number of states including confusion, where he usually lives, traveling in the state of confusion. I have people here too. Oh, your hair looks lovely tonight. What did you do? Were you out in the cold, blowing around in your hair? Look at that. Or did you just run into the shower? Did you run into the shower?
No.
Oh, because you know forget it. We have a shower here in the studio. We have well, we'll talk about that later. These people don't need to know how I fixed the shower head. Oh, you should have a shower head. Well, I got a world record tonight. World record, the count of 64 in and out. At 64.
I don't know.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you're all bringing down the show. I got a very intelligent person coming up. What?
I heard there was a South African that took a shower in 60 seconds.
It wasn't. Wait, that. It's a funny. Was that a running joke? Oh, I see. Oh, I thought you were talking about our prayers, if indeed prayers matter, to anyone out there, go out to Nelson Mandela, who is 94 years old. He was brought back to the hospital this evening or this afternoon. I have no idea what all this time changes. And speaking of time changes, it's 12 hours later. We're on live here. 12 hours later in the Philippines, I want to say hello to Lancey and all our fans down there. I'm saying down there? I don't even know on the map. Over there, way over there in the Pacific, for the Cotolo fan club over there. Now, you know, we started out in Japan where we had the first fan club, and it moved. It only took 15 years to move to the Philippines. That's like slower than the Italians when they took Ethiopia during World War II. All right, now everybody has to be quiet. We're going to get serious, and including me. I'm going to give Dr. Wyatt a call. We're going to move on into this program. It's not a program. It's a show. And now we're going to hear the... Dr. Wyatt has that...
Hello?
Dr. Wyatt has... can we hear me? Dr. Wyatt?
This is Dr. Wyatt.
And, are we coming over... Thank you very much. Let's hear it for Dr. Wyatt. Are you coming over loud and clear?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. How about, can you hear me?
I can hear you just brightly and shiny out there on the mountain time. In Colorado?
Well, I'm in Wyoming right now, Casper, Wyoming, which is my hometown where I grew up.
Oh, that's right, Casper, Wyoming. You grew up where Vice President Cheney grew up, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Everybody laughs. Everybody laughs. Casper.
One thing you want your town to be remembered for.
No, I know. And, Dr. Isn't there anyone? Who else would be popular that would be identified with Casper?
Have you heard of Pete Williams? He's a news anchor.
Yes.
He went to my high school.
Oh, good.
I knew him in high school. We were in drama together.
Ah, you were in a drama together, or
in drama classes together, the drama club.
He worked for the Bush administration for a while before he went to NBC, correct?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
And how was? And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Pete, but that would be. I don't know how many people would know Pete by comparison to knowing Mr. Cheney.
Yeah. Yeah. Possibly not too many.
And that's it. What Wyoming is. Wyoming is a sparsely populated place, isn't it?
Yeah. There's only about 500,000 people who live in the whole state.
So you mean less than Montana?
Yeah, I believe so.
I thought Montana was the least populated state. Wow.
I don't know. We might be close. I don't really know for sure.
So you have like 3 electoral votes then, maybe. 3?
Yeah. Or maybe only 2.
2? If you have 500,000?
Well, I haven't lived here for a long time, so I don't know.
You went back to Casper after?
Well, yeah, this is where I grew up, and my parents continued to live here. So I've been coming back to, I've been cleaning out my mom's house to get it ready to sell.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
So
let's reintroduce you to many of the people who listen to the show regularly and new ones who don't and haven't heard you the first time. You're the author, and as I was saying before I called up there, everybody's an author now. No matter what gender, you're not authoress anymore.
No, just an author.
It's like actors, and yet they still have best actress, and yet they don't call women actresses anymore. They call them actors.
Yeah, that's true.
You wrote What Really Matters, and I told everyone how they can get it and where they can get it. Tell everyone, give everybody a little, you don't have to, I'm not asking for a resume or a bio or anything, but your credentials, which you should be very proud of having in the academic world. Tell them that, because I could call anybody doctor, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm trained as a family practice physician, and I practiced for 25 years, both in family practice and in hospice medicine. Much of the time, I did both at the same time. And for 8 years, I was only in hospice. So I had a long practice career. And I also have training in psychiatry, too.
How many years did you go to extracurricular, if that's the word? No, extra, what is it called when you go beyond 4 years of college?
Postgraduate.
How much postgraduate did you do?
So I did a year of research and then 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency training, and then another year of fellowship in psychiatry. So let's see, what does that add up to?
It's about
13 years.
It's always amazing to me, and I don't say that for any other reason than admiration to. There are so many people I have on this show, that are just amazingly brilliant in an academic sense. I mean, you're brilliant anyway, but you know what I mean. Who have all these credentials? I have, you know, nothing. I have 4 years of escape the draft documents that. but seriously, and that is serious too. The only reason I went to college, but the very fact that you are so devoted. I don't think there's any reason not to brag about that to the audience, so that they know that I'm speaking to someone extremely. I don't even want to use the word intelligent, because I don't think that. I mean, there's a lot of people who are intelligent. I don't think that really. Let's just say, you know, professionally trained. How about that?
Yeah, sounds good.
Now the funny part of this, if there is any funny part of it, for me is funny, is that what really matters, this book, and as the doctor just told you, she has worked with hospice people and been with people who they were dying and dealing with the oncoming change of state of mind, or, you know, I mean, the end of life as we know it, seriously, right? And mm-hmm. And she has done that. We all know people who died, but you have been, and this is, I told someone the other night, I said, you know, I get a little weird thinking about being on the show with you, spending time with you, not for any other reason other than you spend so much time around dying people. I start to feel a little weird.
When I was doing full-time hospice, my children were young, and they kind of got used to the idea that, you know, I would have to leave sometimes in the middle of the night because a patient was dying. Well, once my son had a friend over, and I got a phone call that a patient died, and I kind of told the kids, oh, well, mommy has to go. I have to go to work. I have to go see a patient. So my son said to his friend, oh, my mom's patient just died. And the friend's eyes got huge, and she said, her patient died? And my son said, yeah, all of my mom's patients died. And his friend said, I am never going to her as a doctor.
That's special.
A little bit like that. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I imagine that's I can't even do a joke after that. That is the joke. Yeah, that's true. Kids would think that. Kids are. It's funny how you must know this because you've dealt with children. Haven't you dealt with children, or do you just deal with old people? Or,
no,
I mean, anybody.
Children. Yeah, people of all ages.
And then we'll get into all sorts of stuff that we're going to get into, but just this things that comes up. How does a child, what is the main difference? If you're dealing with a child, does a child recognize death as death? I mean, how do you deal with, what is the difference is what I'm saying? Not how do you deal with it, obviously. What is the difference in the child's attitude if they know life is going to be older and they're surrounded by people who have spent so much more time in life?
What seemed very interesting to me is that the children seemed so much more accepting than any of the adults were about death. The children always seemed to have a calmness about them and no fear for the most part. The children that I worked with, they seemed to have this like higher wisdom in a way, or knowing. And a lot of them had told us about experiences. They had, they would have dreams, and they would see, like one little boy saw a staircase in the corner of the room that went up to heaven. And so in his mind, he knew he would be walking up that staircase one day. And the children were very inspiring to me, because many of them seemed to have this wisdom way beyond their years that prepared them.
Well, again, okay, let me play the devil's advocate for a second here, because we could call that wisdom, or we could just call that vastly underdeveloped brain sense of life or an experience
that allows them, right? Because they don't even know what they're missing. You know, they don't even know what they will be missing out on. What? Or leaving, so.
Yeah, not just that, but I mean, when I was a kid and I watched the thing, I realized that, you know, the cartoons I watched, you know, that there were attitudes and there were things that went with me into my adulthood. But when I was a kid and I watched Heckle and Jekyll, do you remember Heckle and Jekyll?
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah, good. The two crows, were they?
Yeah, they were magpies.
Or magpies, that's right.
I'm actually talking to somebody. I always have to, you know, tell people, you know, write things down and look at them later, because I have a younger audience, and a lot of them don't, they just don't know this stuff, you know. But then they go to YouTube and they, you know, because everything's on YouTube. But, you know, when I was a kid, I actually felt like I could act like Heckle and Jekyll in the world. And this, although this might have had something to do with my development as a rebellious person, it's still, I was a kid, I just felt like, well, there's nothing wrong with that. And so in the sense of dying, not fear, perhaps they do have a rather cartoon, which would not be real, and that helps them in a sense. Are we saying...
Mm-hmm. That's possible. I mean, whatever their understanding of dying is, or heaven, somehow it's not as fearful or frightening or sad to them as the concept we have as adults, I think. I guess I could say that.
Have you ever met a kid who was, and how old are we talking about here now? Before, like pre-10 or 10 or what? How?
The youngest child I worked with was 5.
Well, 5, I guess we can't expect much of anything.
Yeah.
You know. Although there have been cases of people, of children 5, who can really play the banjo well. But we're not. You know, it's funny because, you know, that's, it's true, though. You ever see these kids? Ever these kids who learn piano? These kids who have these natural abilities at very young?
Yeah, phenomenal.
It must be. I know astrologers always say that's very dangerous, because kids who peak too early, they feel, and I'm not agreeing with astrologers, mind you, I'm just saying, that they say that people who peak really early have nowhere to go. But as far as death is concerned, nobody knows where they're going anyway.
That's true.
But still, so did you ever have a kid? And I have a feeling I might have been this kid who would have squawked and screamed and yelled and said, "Oh, what a, you know, what a bum deal."
Well, yeah, we had some young people more in their early 20s who were really, really angry and upset that they had terminal illnesses.
And kids in their early 20s are filled with angst anyway, aren't they?
yeah, definitely. Already still trying to figure out what their life is about, and then to find out that it's ending.
I was thinking today, because we were going to talk, and especially since... you're talking about, you're going to mention the fact that and I have mentioned the fact that you've had a, another personal experience with death.
Mm-hmm.
And, when your mother died, when?
January 11th of this year.
And then your father has been dead a while now.
Yeah, 24 years ago. Okay. Almost.
There is something that I've always heard about, and I have lost both my parents, so I can attest to this, and you're being a psychologist and knowing psychiatry and everything can tell me whether I'm nuts or not. like I need one more person to tell me I'm nuts.
Well,
there is a thing I heard about a long time ago before both my parents went, and I prepared myself for this, and that is that when a person loses both their parents, they experience something that's called free fall. She's silent now. She's going like, "Yeah, who told you that?" Right? And that is that that one parent dying is one thing, but both parents dying. If you live and both parents die, this feeling, this free fall state, is exactly what it the metaphor of free fall, that you do experience this this disconnection with the things that you identified, the important things that you identified with having parents. Has you experienced any of this, or have you heard of this, or
Yeah, I haven't heard that term before, but I can just say personally, that's kind of what I'm experiencing right now, because we're in the process of selling my parents' house, which was their house for 60 years, and it's the house I grew up in. And this feeling of I won't have a home anymore, you know, like that house has always represented my ultimate home, where I'm from. And
well, there it is. I mean, that's okay. You never heard the term, but what you're saying is that you're not going to feel grounded. So
yeah, it's a little frightening.
Now, you knew your mom was dying, correct?
Yes. Yeah, she was diagnosed with cancer in December.
Okay, so here you have a case where you are – okay, so we'll throw out the general trauma, because I always think there's trauma anyway. I knew both my parents were dying, and there was still trauma, after. Yeah. But so we'll throw out the initial trauma, which is, of course, an accident or something, just, falling from the sky or whatever. And let's look at the fact that you knew your mother – was dying. She's diagnosed with cancer. It was terminal cancer, right?
Yes.
Okay. And here's you, Dr. Karen Moyet, who's written books and has been spent all your adult life, I guess, with dying people. Now you're with your mom. How different is this in that connection as opposed to just having the disconnection? Could you perform and present yourself and your professional, attributes to this, or were you emotionally in turmoil? Or is any of this my business? I mean, is it okay if I bring this up?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
It's kind of a yes and no situation. I mean, I was so grateful for the knowledge that I have, because I went up to take care of her, and I went up there thinking I was taking care of her for the last month of her life, and she died within 5 days after I got there.
Ooh.
So she was kind of hanging on, waiting for me to come, like my getting there was her chance to go. And I didn't know, I didn't know it. I didn't know that she was that close to dying, but I was so glad for my hospice experience, because I had lots of knowledge, lots of knowledge about what to do. What I didn't realize, because in all the patients I had visited with, I would come and go. I'd come and visit for an hour and leave the household and go see another patient. Mm-hmm. And when you're there 24/7 as the caregiver, it's so much more demanding. And I didn't realize I didn't sleep for 5 days. I was more than half an hour at a time, because I was constantly up and down taking care of her. And I didn't know how stressful it would be physically and emotionally. So I saw myself kind of go into this weird state of being sleep deprived and kind of lost track of what time of day it was. I didn't know if it was day or night or what day of the week it was. But I was in this zone with her, taking care of her.
Well, in this zone, what is driving you? Is it the need? Is there something going on in a part of you that says I can keep her alive, or is there something that says I have to spend now every last moment making her comfortable? Exactly where is that? And I'll tell you my experience, and then you could diagnose me. Go ahead.
Okay. For me, I was not wanting to keep her alive, because I knew so much that she was ready to go. She really wanted to. And my issue was wanting to keep her comfortable. But that involved a lot of adjusting pillows and moving covers and heating up her heating pad and then cooling it off and bringing her sips of water, all kinds of little gestures to help keep her comfortable.
And she had all her faculties that she knew, or she wasn't drugged up or flying away somewhere?
No, she was very with it for the first 3 days. And then on the fourth day that I was there, she went into a coma.
Oh, man.
Which is, that's when I first realized, like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen a lot quicker than I thought it would. And and I was shocked, and I wasn't quite ready for her to go, but I knew that I knew how much she wanted to. So I just needed to be there and support her through it.
Well, let's talk, because I had a similar experience in terms of the coma. And let's talk about that. This Cotolo Chronicles, we're talking with Dr. Karen Wyatt. Many of you out there may be going, look, I don't want to hear this. But, you know, everybody's going to have to deal with something like, well, we're not going to have to. I mean, you hope that you have to, because you could at least live long enough. So stick with us here. The book is What Really Matters, and we'll talk more about all that stuff there, too. But we're talking about... my mother went into a coma, and I had heard all these things about talking to people in comas. And now just come along with me on this. Work with me on this, doctor.
Okay.
That's right, isn't it? All those things about talking to people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is that just a way to make the person who's not in the coma feel better? Or is there actually some way of... proving that they can hear, or what? How do we know?
Well, you know, I think we know from observation, and with my mom, she was in a coma that day, but about that particular day, she had about 12 different visitors during the day who just happened to show up and stop by. And as each person came in the room to see her, she was in a coma, but I leaned over and whispered to her the name of the person who was there. You know, Mom, so-and-so has come to see you. For every single person, she opened her eyes and smiled at that person.
Okay.
And so I know that she heard me, and I know that she, and a few of the people, she whispered, I love you, to them before she closed her eyes again. So I know she heard me, and she was able to make a connection with the people who came. It was really phenomenal.
Yeah, that's an extreme case, isn't it? I mean, to actually open your eyes and smile, because the reaction I was going to tell you was nothing like that. But I did have a similar experience, although it was certainly not as pleasant as that. And I didn't know when I was doing this, I did not know if this was true. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I had no proof or anything. I had no experience. My father passed away when I wasn't there in the hospital. But there I was, and my mother was in this coma. And I had already, and I also had I had already told the doctor, because, you know, they have to ask you, right? They have to ask you whether you want to keep them on or not, don't they?
Yes, okay. Yes.
But I already made that decision not to. And so there I am talking with the, and I'm, you know, and that's the kind of decision, you know, not only don't you want to make, you don't really know if, you know, you don't know which, you don't know what to do. Okay. So anyway, I'm sitting there talking, and I'm saying things, and I'd already pretty much, I'd had, and I'm sure you did too. You made peace with whatever when your mother was cognizant and stuff, right? I mean, you settled a lot of stuff, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay. And I did too. So I was fortunate for that, because didn't happen with my father. But here I am doing this, and I was saying things that, I think she'd want to hear. Not that I didn't feel them, but I was telling her personal things and stuff and just talking into her ear. Did not open her eyes to do anything, okay? And this could be totally coincidence, but I guess I'm convinced it's not, because it happened to me, just like you're saying. These things happen, and because we do have by observance. I'm not going to describe this in great detail. The point is that I was talking to her, and I said a few things that I know she wanted to respond to. You know, I love you too, or whatever she wanted to say back that she couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw her head kind of move or what have you, and she had been just sitting there all the time, and she began to, I don't even know how to say this without saying, you know, I don't want to say vomit, but I just did. But, you know, stuff started coming out of her.
Uh-huh.
As disgusting as that might sound, it was pretty disgusting, although it's really not. In other words, there was some kind of response. The stuff started happening, and I called, nurse, quick. There was no reason why that had to happen at that moment, unless something, as I thought to myself, somehow she was mustering up every piece of energy she had to be able to respond.
Yes.
Am I correct in assuming that's not just a fantasy, is it?
No, that makes sense to me because I've seen many things like that before.
And this happened, and I just knew it. Of course, I wanted to know it, but I was being, you know, I hate to be so pragmatic, but I am. I wanted to know it, but I did feel well in knowing that she responded, no matter how. Okay.
Yes.
So we are. So like I said, it wasn't open your eyes and hey, thanks a lot, Frankie, or whatever, or smile or anything. It was nothing because she too had many visitors, and there was some. You know, even before she went into the coma, and she maintains a remarkable sense of humor. My mother had a remarkable sense of humor that she did not know she had. It's kind of the worst kind. It is. It's the worst kind. But is and so then we can assume that, and we could tell people if we're going to say anything as two people who have had these experiences that if someone close to you or a loved one is in a coma, you should do what? You tell. I'm not going to go to me.
Well, I think you should definitely talk to them if there are things you need to say or that you want them to hear. But also know, maybe be careful about the conversations that happen in front of them because they assume that they can hear you is what I'm saying. And so,
wait a second, say that again, please.
Assume that the person in the coma will hear what you're saying, so you might want to be careful about what you say about them. You know, I mean, think about it.
Why would anyone? I mean, who would stand there and berate somebody who was in a coma?
I mean, hopefully people wouldn't be, you know, bad-mouthing their loved one in front of them while they're on their deathbed. But just a thought to remember that they. There's a good chance that they will hear on some level what's being said.
I think that there's a part in Somerset Maugham's book, The Razor's Edge, mm-hmm. where at the end the main character Larry is with somebody somebody's on his deathbed. He's not in a coma, but he's on his deathbed, and he makes a gesture. He does something, and it's a lie. Okay, it's a lie. But he does it because on a spiritual higher level, you know, it doesn't matter. The man is leaving his mortal shell, and he does something that makes the person feel well because of the instant. I don't have to go into it. I'm not going to go into it. You know what I mean? He does something. And I always took that to heart, which I imagine is what, you know, Mr. Maugham wanted, to show that it is even important that you send messages perhaps, again, I'm not saying lie, but I'm saying send good messages. Maybe just be, like you said, be quiet if there's anything bad you want to say. Don't say it. But couldn't you press it? Isn't it important to press it, to push it a bit, even if it's not totally true?
What I felt was the need to say, I said to her, Mom, you've done everything you've been asked to do in your life. You've done a great job. You've lived a beautiful life. It's okay for you to go. I felt like it was really important for her to have some closure and feel that. Because I think most people are looking for that and want to know, like, gee, did I blow it? Or, you know, did I do okay with this lifetime? And so for me, everything, any differences we had in the past were forgotten and over with. And I wanted to say to her, you know, thank you for this life you've lived and everything you've given me, and send her on her way with that good feeling.
And in that sense, and this is another reason why I think it's important to do whatever it is, like you said, in good feelings, or like I said, I would just flat out lie if I had to, because I think that, I know this, you and I were placed in, it's a lot of luck to have that opportunity. And I'm not, obviously not lucky when a person is dying, they're in a coma, or they're old, what have you, but there's nothing, I mean, a lot of people don't get the chance. I had a close friend who himself has now passed away, but he always told me about his father who was particularly young, and the boy was young, at a party with your family party where the father was drinking, and he saw his father, like, die right there. I mean, he had a massive heart attack, and he just, you know, fell down and died. And that stood with him because he did not have any opportunity, forget about growing and having more of a relationship with his father, but just the simple fact that he couldn't say goodbye or thank you or anything.
Yes.
That's a burden we that a lot of people carry, and a lot of people carry, even if it's not their mother and father, with anyone, you know, other people that are close to you, correct?
Oh, definitely. And that was one of my issues with my dad's death, not being able to say goodbye to him. And so that made my mom's death particularly sweet for me in a way, because I was kind of trying to make up for it, I guess, to make up for what didn't get to happen with my dad.
I know that exactly, because that's exactly what happened to me. I knew my father was dying, but I denied in a certain sense. And I was trying to be so strong for my mother, you know, that I just let fly what I should never have let fly, you know, when I had the last chance to see him. I just imagine it wouldn't be the last chance. So you do have to live with that kind of thing. So I did. I tried to make up also. But still, finding ourselves in a fortunate position to be able to do that.
Yes.
And I, in a certain way, I guess if you never knew your other parent, I don't know then, right? There's so many different situations. How does this situation now, what do you think? And nobody even cares what I think. They don't care what you think. If you have you don't have two mothers, but I mean, in a chance of same-sex a marriage or civil union or anything where they're raising a child, and regardless of sexual preference, because I don't understand why that's always the first, you know, thing that we have to look at a person. I don't think so. But having two mothers or two fathers and then dealing with the same thing, there's really, am I mistaken in thinking there's going to be no real difference in anything? Correct?
I would think so. I guess I haven't been through a situation like that as far, you know, professionally as a hospice doctor. I haven't seen it, but I would think it's still the same thing. They're people that you love who raised you. And so.
Sure. If there were three, right? Wouldn't you, if there were three people, I mean, maybe an aunt lived with you and your aunt, your mother, and a sister. I mean, you would.
Sure.
Yeah. So it would be the same thing. But you haven't had any experiences with that?
No, not that I can think of.
Okay, so then let's get back to this free fall thing in a sense. So then let me just say again, since we're top of the hour, we're not going to break. We're going to stay with Dr. Wyatt for as long as we can here. You okay over there? And you okay to stay with us?
Yep, I'm okay.
Okay,
I'm
great. Good. So here you are now, and I had to do the same thing, clean out the house and then sell the house, and are you an only child?
No, I have an older brother.
Okay, so situations are more similar than we think, only you still remain much smarter than me. Other than that. Okay, so here you are having to sell this house. Why don't you keep the house?
Well, I don't live here. My brother does live here, but he has his own house and property that he has to maintain, and he just doesn't want to have to, he wouldn't want to have to take care of another house and yard. The house has a huge yard with it, and it would be a lot of work to maintain, so.
Do you think that time will heal all wounds? Because I have this philosophy. It's a philosophy, and you tell me, because you've dealt with people who've died and dying and whatever, but let me tell you this. I think that mourning, certainly not to debilitate your activity in life and moving on, but I think it's a very important thing to continue in your life, so that you have a certain respect for the people who have left. And so I spend time when it comes up in me, whether it comes up in me, well, lots of times, you know, when my parents were dead, it came up with me, like in therapy and stuff. But still, I mean, whenever it comes up, because there are times, you know, when you suddenly feel like you're acting a certain way and you go, wow, that's my mother. Or, boy, that's my father. Mm-hmm. And at those particular times, and also on like Mother's Day and Father's Day, no matter how many years passed or what have you, I think it's important to continue a certain amount of mourning, you know, a certain feeling towards people who have been close to you or helped you. Am I not? Is that nutty, or do you? What do you feel about that? Because time, time never erases any of this stuff, does it?
No, I don't think so. I agree with you. I think it's really important to keep honoring those, you know, the past, and honoring our grief. Though I don't think it should control us or limit our ability to live our lives. But I think it's really important, like you said, on those certain anniversary days and important days, to have a space and time where you honor our loved ones who are gone. You know, and there are places I go where I stop and think, oh my gosh, my dad would love it here. My dad would love this. You know, and I always carry his memory, and now my mom's, with me, like, to, in different parts of my life, like, oh, they would love to be here for this. They'd love to see this, or this would make them really happy. And that feels kind of good to me, kind of pleasing to keep them always with me in my heart. And
I appreciate how you use the word honor, and I use the word mourn. I guess, I mean, it's the writer in me. I don't know. There's something dramatic about it. I don't know. I use mourn because I still, and I guess that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I still feel that there's sadness involved, no matter what. You have to be, don't you have to be aware of that?
Oh, yeah. And I think mourn is a good word. I think that is a good word for it. Because I think there will always be sadness and always be like a hole inside somewhere, you know?
And it's probably more damaging to try to block that, isn't it, than to feel it?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think definitely. We're so much better feeling our real feelings and owning up to them than trying to bury them and suppress them.
You could send your bill to me, Frank Catolo. I feel like I know I'll feel better by saying, like, you know, I guess we all need certain confirmation, right? Because even though something makes us feel good, I mean, I don't talk about this stuff a lot, but I do. Because of broadcasting, and because of writing, and because of the characters that I've created of my parents in terms of my writing and stuff, the things I like to remember about them the best are, you know, are all good things. And they're a funny thing, but I amplify them because they mean more to me than I think my parents even knew they would mean to me. So I find this a state of reverence for these people that are partially characters I've created. I mean, they are the people. They are those people. But I've taken them and have massaged those characteristics into things that have been positive for me. Like my sense of, I'm telling you, my mother had a great sense of humor. She did not know. And I think that, you know, I like to attribute then parts of my sense of humor, which have helped me make a good living for many years, to her. Right? I mean,
yeah, I love that idea of creating characters based on your parents. And then I think that's beautiful. You know, that word, honoring your parents and creating characters and turning all of their traits into something positive or something enjoyable or entertaining.
Entertaining and enjoyable is it. I opened my book, Molotov Memoirs, with a story called The Portrait of a Child as Stupid. And I talk constantly about what they did. They didn't know they were doing anything particularly bad to me in terms of my environment and growing up, and now it's funny. I mean, I could take it, and it's funny now to know that how many, if I would have a nickel for every time my father called me stupid, you know, all my life, I would, you know, be a billionaire. But it was stupid. Because, I mean, the way it was used wasn't really bad. I mean, if you're a kid and your father calls you stupid, and every time he does, they smack you in the back of the head, I imagine after the 20th time, now you're 35, you're going to need a lot of therapy, correct?
Yeah, I would think so.
But when it's used as terms, and when you understand later on that it's a term, it doesn't mean I was stupid. It was just another way of, in other words, they could not express themselves the way I have. And I always think to myself, God, you know, I've lived five lives compared to my father.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you must know this too, because your parents, from whatever generation they were in, we were not afforded the same experiences. They certainly didn't have 13 years of post-college, did they?
Oh, no, no. Right. Neither one of my parents went to college, and they lived pretty narrow lives, you know, compared to the experiences I've had. And
this continues, and I think maybe it's important that you and I are sharing this with younger people that are able to understand that this drama, these battles that, well, I'll say let's use drama, that you have with your parents when you're, you know, searching for your identity or what have you, that all these things have become really embraceable elements of your life later on.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of fascinating to see it happen, you know, to see all those battles transform, and suddenly at a place later in life, you realize that's what made you stronger, and that's what almost created who you are, and it's beautiful, and you feel grateful for it at some point.
Now, let's look at the other side of that coin, and that is that the ones who don't, how are you able, how should people be able to, in other words, let's look at the kid who's hit on the back of the head and called stupid. And how are these people, what should they do if they find themselves in situations in their own life, their parents are gone, what should they do to be able to look at anything positive? I mean, or to settle that? I hate the word closure because, as I said, I mourn. I don't believe in closure. That, to me, that's – it's shut it away. It's gone.
Put it you're away. You're not closing it or closing it off.
I like to leave it open. But what are people who are having trouble with this kind of thing? What advice do you as a professional – I realize you're going to have to give this for free, but – maybe you'll sell a few books. I just say, what do you tell the people who are still, wrestling with things, or people whose parents are, they, even people who get in this situation like you, they don't realize this is it. You better settle this now.
Well, when people are looking for a way to try to resolve some of these old issues, my approach is to try to take the perspective of the other person. And so for me, even understanding my own parents, I needed to learn as much as I could about them, about their lives, and what did they go through? What did they experience? To remind myself, you know, life was pretty tough for our parents who grew up through the Depression, and World War II. They went through a lot of challenging times, and they also were raised by parents who had very little knowledge or understanding of parenting and parents who were struggling to survive and didn't really have any free energy or time to give love to their own kids. So our parents grew up without very much love in their lives as children and didn't really know how to parent children themselves. And so anyway, the more I learned about my own parents, the more I felt forgiving and compassionate toward them, that to realize, wow, they really did the best they could with what they knew and understood and had experienced in their own lives. They may have made some mistakes, or I can call them mistakes now, but they had a lot to try to deal with and go through in their own lives.
Now, what about younger, I mean, X generation and millennium kids who are children of parents who have been brought up in this whole new wave of parenting, and they've had it pretty well, because a lot of children walk around with feelings of entitlement because of it or what have you. How do they deal? With that, because it's the opposite of you and I, because I know what you're saying, and obviously I'm saying when my father said stupid, well, you know, my father was not intelligent, he was not smart, you know, so I could take that and I could put that in a big cauldron of, elements of character and make it funny and wonderful, but knowing, as you said, that I got to know them and where they came from and the problems they had, what about now when we're looking at people who are not supposedly – there was no other Great Depression or something.
Well, and, you know, part of it, it's just inherent in the growing up process. You know, one of the jobs of parents is to be to create conflict with their children. Like, that's part of how children grow, by conflicting with their parents and rebelling against them. And so even if you have the most loving, congenial parents who give you everything, the children still need to rebel and still need to disagree with their parents on some level or another. So every one of us will grow up with some sort of resentment or bad feelings, regardless of the quality of parenting we received, because that's just that's the normal process of how we separate from our parents. So to answer one question, you know, regardless of how much our parents know about parenting, we're all going to grow up with negative feelings about our parents. So in a way, it's a similar process at some point of, you know, one of the things I emphasize in my book is the need for forgiveness. And at some point, you have to do work in order to forgive people. And part of that work is understanding who they are and where they came from and what their life has been for them.
Yeah, and forgiveness is a large order. I think we all can agree with that. Right?
Yeah.
That's a large, really big one. I don't know when you know exactly how. I always went for that moment. You know, you could say it all you want. I forgive you. And then there's, you know, part of me that goes like, nah, I don't think I do. You know, it's like, I don't know. I don't. What does it feel like if it's totally gone?
You know, for me, like, in all the years I spent in hospice, that's the one thing I saw every single patient working on at the end of life was forgiveness. And I wrote a chapter in the book about that.
Right.
So I myself have spent a lot of years concentrating on forgiveness now, because I figured I got to get some of this done now, so it's not all there at the very end of life, and I'm trying to forgive people or forgive myself. And so I've been working on forgiveness for a long time, and I thought, I have totally forgiven my mom. I have no bad feelings toward her. But there she is on her deathbed, and I'm taking care of her. And she's telling me, no, that's not how you fold the blanket. like this. No, move that here. Do that right. And I'm suddenly so angry at her and saying, oh, I guess I can't do anything right, can I? And I'm like 14 years old again.
Wow. Yeah.
And mad at my mom. So I had to walk out of the room and think, wow, I didn't finish this. I'm not done. I'm not done with my forgiveness work. And I thought I was, but those last few days of taking care of her really gave me the opportunity to work through it. And it was very interesting. I just felt it, the two of us forgiving one another as we kind of worked this out. Like, how are we going to get through this? How are we going to do this? And I finally said to her, Mom, I'm doing the best I can. You know, I'm trying to help you.
And you have to, and you have to believe that. But see what you did, I got to stop you at this point, that because it's like what you did, I mean, you've been in psychiatry, you know all this stuff, but what you did, as I understand it, is the most you can do in terms of dealing with that stuff, and that is that you recognized what happened. You did not react to it and suddenly start yelling at your mother who was sitting there dying. I mean, you didn't become 14 and go through that again. That recognition of what's happening is, of course, isn't that pretty much the ultimate step, but then how you deal with that?
Definitely. That's the first and most important step, is as soon as you become aware of it. Because then, like, you're right. It didn't matter that those feelings came up in me. It's that I knew how to control the feelings so that I wouldn't express it to her or act on it. You know, and so.
That's something I didn't know. I didn't understand when I first went into therapy. When I learned that, I said, oh, my goodness. You know, as horrible as that might be, the point is, is it horrible? In other words, as horrible as it might be that you have to recognize it, maybe that's why people don't recognize it and react to it. But as horrible as that might be, it also is terrific, because now I know why I'm doing that, and I can actually behave different because I know that feeling is not really now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, my mom and I had an interesting experience in the middle of the night when I was taking care of her. She kept trying to climb out of bed. She really wanted to get out of bed.
She was that strong?
She was too weak to stand up on her own, but so I had to keep telling her she had to stay in bed, and she waited until she had me go get her a cup of tea or something. So I left her in the room to go heat up her tea. I came back in and she was trying to climb out of bed and I had to grab her, you know, put my arms around her and grab a hold of her and hold her on the bed. So she was kind of struggling and fighting with me on the, sitting on the edge of the bed, and I have my arms around her chest, and she turned around to me and she said, "I used to tie you to the chair." And suddenly I had a memory of being a little kid, and she tied me to my high chair with a dish towel so that I wouldn't climb out of the high chair, because I was trying to climb out of the chair. And so all of a sudden, between the two of us, we had this recognition. And I suddenly said, now I know, you know, I remembered, I've probably been angry my entire life that she tied me to the chair, but suddenly I knew why, because she didn't want me to get hurt. She was afraid I'd fall.
And how old were you when she tied you in the high chair?
I mean, I was probably, you know, less than 2 years old. Oh. I was a little kid, but she was afraid that I would climb out.
Yeah, but what's important here is the fact that you're saying that we have these feelings we don't even interpret. We can't even interpret at a certain age, and then later on they come up without us knowing it. Wow,
it was shocking when she said it to me. I could feel it and I could picture it. I could picture a dish towel tied around me, tying me to the chair, and being angry and furious because I couldn't get up. But suddenly it's like I understood for the first time ever why she tied me to the chair, and her fear that I would fall and get hurt, because that's the fear I had for her now. And suddenly she understood why I was holding her down and how mad it made me that she tied me down. You know, suddenly, like, we had this full understanding between us, and that's all that was said. She said that those few words, "I tied you to the chair." And it was profound. The two of us sat there for a minute, and then she relaxed and she laid back down in bed, and it was like, wow, we just traded places.
and that helped me
fully forgive her. Like I said, understanding the other perspective was what I needed.
Yeah, well, but again, you had the feeling, you recognized it, and you didn't say, "You did what?" You know, "You did what?" "Well, take this dish, you know, take a dish rag and I shove it into her mouth." It's like, let me quicken this process. You recognized it and you were able to work right there and go, well, that's where that feeling has come from. Wherever else you got that feeling, you must have gotten it a million times here and there.
Yeah. And it was all about her fear that I would get hurt. And I hated that more than anything, that she was afraid I would get hurt. But suddenly I suddenly had an understanding for it, at least, you know, I kind of understood why, that she wasn't saying something about me, because I interpreted it that she wanted to hold me back. It was simply that she was afraid for me. She was afraid on my behalf that I would get hurt. She was judging me.
I have a cousin who was very, my closest cousin, who practically grew up with me. I usually call her, she's like a sister to me. And I think I have forgiven her eventually. I'm still trying to figure out why she allowed me, she wanted me when we're out in the country, and we're very young. We're out in the country when my grandfather owned a lot of land. And we're out in the country. I'm still trying to figure out what she found so funny about making me sit on a porcupine.
Oh.
but now I'm just bringing this up. It's not a moot point. It's a point, because I think to myself, I have thought, I mean, I never, you know, that was a pretty angry thing when, and that's like, what, you know, that hurts. And they had to take these things out of my butt, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then she laughed and laughed and laughed. And later on, I realized, you know, I guess I was angry about that for a long time, and until it finally dawned on me how funny that actually was. I was in no particular danger, but I wondered to myself, as you know, like, how many things have happened to me? And this is, well, I'm talking about something where I was really, really young, like, you know, I mean, all my first remembrances come from like two places, and one of them is out there in the country. So I do have these flashing images, and I know that a lot of that stuff was not necessarily terrific. And I wonder to myself, because some things have come up in therapy, what have you, in the past, but I, just like you, I'm going like, wow, when I feel a certain way, I always sit back and I go, I wonder, you know, is there any reason for me to feel like this? I wonder where that's originating. What happened back there? Which I guess means you should always be in therapy.
Well, you know, because we know now from brain development that, you know, the brain stores negative memories and negative experiences more strongly and preferentially over positive experiences. So whatever traumas you've had in the past get stored more tightly in your brain. They're held on to, and the brain emphasizes those over positive experiences too. So you're probably right. You know, negative feelings you have now probably do come from something that's stored from way, way back there.
And it doesn't have to be anything particularly heinous either, right? It could be like, my mother always used to say, my mother could never, when it was cold out, she could never address me warm enough. She always felt like I was going to get pneumonia. That was it.
Period. Yeah.
Okay. So she used to say this thing all the time, button your chest. And it just meant, you know, don't leave it open. But that's how she said it. Button your chest. And we could go back to a memory I have where, you know, I'm so dressed. I mean, before I even go outside, I'm sweating inside of layers of clothing. And although that's an endearing thing, she's trying to be sure that I'll be okay and everything like that, I'm actually experiencing a lot of anger.
Yeah. Because like, you probably felt miserable inside all those clothes.
And so therefore, I'm miserable. I'm uncomfortable. And here she is trying to help me. Her action is positive. My reaction is negative. And that means that later on in life, I may get some feelings from very positive reactions that are negative.
Sure. Yeah, because what you store in your memory is at that age, you don't even understand that her actions are positive. All you know is I feel miserable. I'm hot and sweaty.
Yeah. That's you getting tied to the chair. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't limit the right. Just because you, even though you're not saying this to yourself, you're going, I want to move. I'm movement. You've restricted my movement.
Exactly.
That's terrible of you to do that.
And she, I'm 2 years old, and that's what I need to do is move.
Yeah, and she can't explain to you that you'll be hurt or you'll be So Freud had a lot of wisdom, if that's the word, at least to be able to identify the fact, and I think it is a fact now, and you, I'm sure, agree, that before we're cognizant of some of the things that we might be able to understand if someone explained them to us, we're reacting and acting and reacting to things in we're just, the missed messages are just a helter-skelter.
Oh, definitely. You know, I was thinking about my childhood, that I found out that I got encephalitis when I was about 9 months old.
Wow.
And was in the hospital for a few days, and you know, I was thinking about what a traumatic experience that is for a child that young who had no words. I couldn't speak. And so whatever the memories were stored as, they weren't stored as words or language because I didn't have any words yet. And the trauma of, you know, being taken away from my parents and being in a hospital and stuck with needles, like I've often wondered about, wow, you know, imagine what that laid down in my brain about fear. It's amazing that I became a doctor, though. I don't know.
I think it's amazing anybody becomes a doctor. Right?
I mean, you know, why was I drawn to medicine? Because I was kind of traumatized by a hospital at an early age. But
is it not? I mean, I certainly can't analyze you, and I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't play one on the radio, but. But as a person who's learned and dealt with all this stuff, do you do more self analysis than most people? I guess you do, right?
Probably. Yeah.
But it was great. You were greatly assisted by this while taking care of your mother passing, correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and all of the knowledge. In some ways, you know, when I was taking care of her, I had this thought like, wow, everything I've learned for my entire life is coming together right now in this moment for me to take care of my mom. Like, here it is, everything I've learned in medicine and hospice mm-hmm. and all my and spiritual wisdom and psychology, and it's all coming together right now in this moment. And so, it, you know, it really felt like the perfect thing, and I was exactly where I was supposed to be at that time.
Hmm. And now, what in terms of this free fall thing, what do you feel that is not necessarily what you expected to feel in a negative way now that both your parents are gone?
I guess what I'm dealing with it right now, actually, because this is, I'm here for the final trip to clean out the house because we have a buyer who really wants the house and they'll be buying it right away. It's this almost a terror of seeing the house go. I didn't expect it. I have never, since I moved out at age 18, I've never felt attached to that house. I never really cared about it. And so I didn't think it would bother me in the least to sell the house. But suddenly it does because I'm looking at everything in the house and thinking this will be my last time to be here. So I was very surprised how much emotion I feel about that, about the house.
Well, let me tell you something that might, I don't know what it'll do for you, but I went back to this particular house that I had totally identify being with my parents when they finally bought a house somewhere out of an apartment. I was older. And I went back to this house like maybe 30 years later. And I walked down this street, this street where I was, I moved when I was 10. I started at this house in this neighborhood when I was 10. So a lot of my, you know, pre-adult, all my teenage years and everything came from this whole experience. These neighbors, this person, this place. But I went back and I walked from the corner down to my house. My house was about four or five houses down from the avenue. And this is in Brooklyn, New York, so it's a pretty densely populated area. And I felt larger. I felt larger. And I almost missed the house because I looked for the addresses and I went, wait, this is supposed to be it. And this house had been so changed. It was so... And it's not redecorated because I don't think it was redecorated. It was almost rebuilt. I don't know what they did. I didn't go inside. I would have wanted to go inside, but I didn't. The entire area had been taken over. I say taken over. It was like being in Tel Aviv. This was like being in the whole Hasidic Jewish nation was now this block, you know? And it was amazing because I knew there were a few, you know, Hasidic Jews in the neighborhood at the time because, you know, they used to give us little pieces of candy to go in the house and turn the lights off on Seder and stuff because they couldn't touch that. So we knew them, but they were all, you know, characters in this big play where there were Italians, there were Irish, there was everything. Now, it was like the Jewish Disneyland here, you know?
Wow.
And the house, I didn't recognize it. I'm stood there, first of all, feeling taller. I don't know why I felt larger. I can't figure this out. I'm not that much bigger than I was when I was 17. But then and I'm looking at this place, I'm going, this is... I can't, and then I saw a lady come out of the house, the side of the house, side entrance. And I gotta tell you that without going into any more great detail about this, the point was this. I was totally disconnected from everything. Totally. That house was now a creation of somewhere, someplace in my head. I mean, it didn't exist anymore, and they had changed it. And, of course, you know, things are going to change anyway, what have you. But it was gone. It was gone. This was not the house. It's gone. There was no reason to stand there and shed a tear or anything or think about anything. It was just gone. It was obliterated. It was destroyed. I'm using these words like it was killed, you know. I mean, that's the way I'm using the words. But and I don't mean it that way because they're, you know, they're okay people, and they took over the place, and they took the whole neighborhood. But it was, I did not have any feeling that, you know, that I had when I left or when I sold the place. So should you, I guess, I don't know. I mean, what do you think if you went back in 20 years?
Yeah. So, yeah, maybe this emotion is just for now. It's just part of this process of saying goodbye. And then the house itself isn't going to mean that much to me down the road, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. What, you have a gang out there, this is Cotolo Chronicles, and what we're chronicling today is something that doesn't necessarily have, is not necessarily dated. In fact, because of the experience and wisdom of, and knowledge of Dr. Karen Wyatt, we also can learn a lot more about this kind of stuff. Because, you know, there weren't shows like, not even shows like this, I don't mean to pat myself on the back or you on the back. The point is, these things weren't talked about. They didn't really talked about these things, no less talked about it so that the entire world could hear it. You know, anybody could tune in this right now alive, and then they're going to hear this. It's going to be on all next week on any number of stations, and people are going to hear this. And these things were just never, they were never talked about. So what happened was what? People just, the legacy of everybody was terrible. I mean, there were terrible legacies because this stuff wasn't talked about.
People didn't deal with their emotions, you know, family emotions and issues before death. So they carried on a lot of wounds and resentment and bad feelings after someone died. And, but I was interested that you yourself said, you didn't know for sure when your mom was dying, what she might want at the end of life.
Yeah.
And that comes again because we don't talk about it. So we don't even know. We don't know, even know what our parents' wishes are or what they would like or how they'd like to be treated at the end of life.
I guess I had just assumed that, since she was, clinging, and I mean, my mother was, is that codependency? That's what they call it now. My mother, even apologized to me well before she died when she had her first bout with cancer and apologized to me for making me afraid of everything because she said she clung, she didn't really care about her own life as much as she cared about me. And she just, you know what I'm, is this, what is this anyway? What are we talking about here?
Yeah.
You know that?
The form of codependency, yeah.
And she was so protective of me because she felt if I died, there was, you know, her life was worth nothing anyway, say. Mm. So her matters of self-esteem and everything, which I learned about and I understood why she, you know, she could feel that way all her life, because of things that happened to her as a kid. But she apologized to me for that because she said, you know, I didn't realize how much I held you down, how much fear I injected into you for this. She didn't think she was doing that. Again, it's the negative, it's a positive negative thing.
Yeah. She didn't mean to do that. It wasn't, she was, no. Again, it came from a positive intent. But.
Yeah, but here's what was really, I thought, here's what was essential to me. Yes, it came from a positive thing. She didn't know any better, what have you. But it was like so late in her life that she realized, I want to say she apologized to me. Why? Because she said, I was so selfish. She understood that. You know, that's like, to me, that's like, wow, I don't want to live my life to be, and I am now, as I'm as old as my parents were when they died. So this is like, that's a whole nother thing, you know?
Wow.
But I said to myself back then when I was 30 years younger, I said, I don't want to live my life that long to figure something like that out.
Yeah, at the last minute.
Wow. It's like, how could you not have figured that out? You know, as I'm saying, like, yeah. how did you just figure that out? Who helped you? What happened? So, what happened was she suddenly got so in touch with her mortality, I think.
Yeah.
That it came about. And she saw me going around the world doing all sorts of things that she never would have allowed me to do anyway, you know? And it was okay. I don't know. I'm just trying to explain that. But to me, the epiphany was that she realized that was so selfish and horrible of her. And that's what And that was a total freedom thing. So when she was in her coma, I just knew it was important that, you know, I tell her I love her and it was okay and blah, blah, you know, and what have you. Because I did, I mean, I felt that way. It was all right, even though, but I didn't sit there and say, you know, it's going to be horrible when you're gone. It's like, you know, I'm going to imagine you at 80 sitting at a holiday. Having, I didn't tell her all those things, which, of course, is still true, you know. So yeah, I don't know, but you know, did you know what your mother wanted? I mean, did you, because of a will, I mean, what did you?
Yeah, know? We had talked about it a number of times, and it was actually really helpful because she read my book, and so, you know, it brought up a lot of issues that we were able to talk about my dad's death, and then she filled out this. It's a type of a living will called Five Wishes.
Oh, I have that. Where did I get that? Wait a second. This is weird because I found this the other day. You're telling me about that? I have it right here. And huh, I kept it out. This is amazing. It is amazing. I found it. It's a hospice thing, correct?
Yeah.
I don't know why I have this, but someone gave this to me. Or I used to work at, I used to do shows entertain people at assisted living quarters, right? Uh-huh. You know. And maybe that's where I got it. I don't know. But I have this thing from hospice. The person I want to make care decisions for me when I can't, the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want, how comfortable I want to be, how I want people to treat me, what I want my loved ones to know. Those are the five wishes, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
So you had this and filled it out with your mom?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she filled it out and we talked over each one of those questions together a number of years ago, actually. But it was wonderful. Having done that, it was really clear. I mean, I knew that she wanted to die at home if she could. She didn't want to go to a hospital. She didn't want any kind of medical intervention. She just wanted to be peaceful and comfortable at home. And luckily for her, I had the training and the willingness to do that for her, to take care of her at home. So,
but so then where would you suggest that people get a hold of something like this?
Absolutely, because that's one of the best things we did. We had such a good conversation, and it was really helpful for us to just talk it through. And it made her really comfortable, and she brought it up over and over. She kept saying, you remember my five wishes, don't you? Do you still have that copy, my five wishes? And, you know, but it was comforting to her to think, I've written down and thought through what I want and how I want things to be. And it was also really good because my brother, who's, you know, doesn't have any medical training, was a little bit freaked out and uncomfortable with her being at home. You know, I mean, he would come over and he said, Mom looks terrible. Don't you think we should take her to the hospital? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, she's dying. But she wants to be home.
She looks terrible. She looks terrible. Yeah, she's dying. I love that. Can I use that sometime in a play or something?
Yeah, you can use it. So, but, you know, I said, remember, she wants to stay home. And I said, it's okay, because I'm taking care of her. And if this is normal, this is how people look, you know, this is all right. But it helped give me a way to reassure him, like, remember, this is what she wants, because she wrote it down for us in her five wishes. And so, because otherwise it's hard when other family members get involved who, you know, who don't have the same comfort level, and there's disagreement about what we should do or how to handle medical situations.
On the suggestion of Dr. Wyatt, I'm going to give you working website for hospice. This is a specific hospice that I have here, but I'm sure we'll have hospices in our own area. This is Hospice of Central Pennsylvania, but I think the website is universal, and you could probably get this from there. It's agingwithdignity.org. Is that still?
Yes, yeah. I think that's still the website. And then I think you can get a copy of it for like 50 cents or something. You know,
really? Where?
Of five
at a bookstore or something?
No, online. You order it online and they send it to you. Or at least that's how I got it. But
I got to mention this because I think this is funny because I always, I don't know why, but I just, my mind, this is the way my mind works. On the back, there's a picture of two people. One of them is elderly and one of them is younger. And the younger one is leaning over and they're both smiling. And the younger one is got her arms around the older one, who's, they're both females. And it says, when time matters most. And then it says Hospice of Central Pennsylvania. I guess what's really weird to me about this is that the lady who is old and apparently dying is, you know, old. She's, you know, 70s, 80s, and Caucasian. And the person hugging her is an African American. I don't understand this picture.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's like, who edited this thing? Immediately I get to, who edited this thing? Why would that be? What does that mean? I think the Aging with Dignity people need a call. I'll give them a call. So can you change that picture on the back cover? But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. But this is a lot of pages. Wow. This is you got to fill this form out. This is like, you called it a living will, I guess.
Yeah, it's a type of a living will that just tells people what your wishes are.
It says there are 5 wishes states. If you live in the District of Columbia or one of the 40 states listed below, you can use 5 wishes and have the peace of mind to know that it substantially meets your state's requirements under the law. What does this mean, doctor?
It means that this document is legal, you know, stands up in court. Like, if you need to, you can be given to your doctor and to the hospital as your living will and your advanced directive, as they call it, for how you want to be treated, because it's recognized in those states as an official document that they accept.
What happened to the other states? Why? I mean, if you...
I don't know. I think the other states haven't gone through the process of approving it, and it might just be that nobody has submitted it for approval in those states. Yeah. I don't know.
It says here, how do I change to 5 wishes if you have already have a living... Isn't it strange that I found this?
Yeah, that's really funny.
Nothing to do with your being on here. I just happened to find this while I was cleaning up. It says you destroy all copies of your old living will. Anyway, and people can find this too. So if you live in any of these states, I wish I could just mention the states that aren't here, but I can't do the subtraction. I know that your Wyoming is here, Vermont, Virginia, Tennessee, South Dakota, South Carolina, Rhode Island, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas. Wait a second. Well, of course, I have to be here. Pennsylvania. New York is here. The Maine. The big populated places are here. What's missing? I don't see Alabama.
Montana?
No Alabama. And yes, Montana's here. Hmm. No Alabama. Georgia's here. Let's see about Mississippi's here. I don't see Florida's here. I can imagine Florida. I mean, that's the land of old people. Imagine it'd be not. What's missing? West Virginia? Virginia's here.
Texas?
You're right, it's missing. Wow. Texas. If you're dying, attention, please. If you're dying in Texas, please, immediately, you think you could do?
The Lone Star.
The Lone Star. You'll never be more alone. Wow, no Texas. Maine is here. Well, anyway, there's a number of places.
Alaska.
Alaska's here. Georgia, Hawaii is even here. Delaware, Connecticut. I don't know
Wisconsin.
Why these. Wisconsin is here. Michigan is here. Idaho. Idaho, Iowa, Illinois. Those are the I's. The I's have it. Who else?
Iowa.
Yes, Iowa, Illinois, and Idaho.
Louisiana. Yes.
Louisiana is here.
Missouri. Yeah.
This is okay. All right. This is not a game show for guys. My son. Here. Fill these out for me. Will you? My son. Okay. So then you could go to Aging with Dignity and get that.
New Mexico.
Are you, New Mexico? Yes. New Mexico's here. It's not new and it's not Mexico. What's that all about? Are you working on another book or are you going to do something else? In writing, because it seems to me that book needs an addendum or a subscript or something.
Yeah, I have ideas for a couple of books, and I'm going to actually write one about my mom's death, just because I kind of need to. It'll be really therapeutic for me, and you know that What Really Matters has 7 lessons in it, and my mom and I ended up kind of living through those, all seven of those lessons during the last days of her life. And so, and I told you about the forgiveness episode, but so I'm going to write about that partly for my own therapy. And, right now it's interesting that you mentioned the idea of wondering what kind of, how your emotions now are connected to your childhood and how far back in your childhood. 'Cause I'm creating a workshop on healing the hidden wounds of childhood. Mm. And it's going to be an audio workshop that people can listen to, and it's going to have a lot of kind of a workbook of things to work through. And
Sell that.
Yeah,
that could be gigantic. Let me know when you have a product going. I'll give you commercials all over the place for that.
Yeah. I'm getting it together right now, so hopefully.
So it's going to be audio, is it a workbook and audio tapes?
Yeah. And probably like a PDF file, because I wanted it to be a home study course so people can do it at their own pace. Yeah. They can listen to the audios and do the work, but it's because it takes a while. You have to kind of be at each step. You have to stop and go through your own process, you know? So I want people to be able to just do it on their own.
Think that should be something of a requirement. You know, as opposed to sitting around, I'm not going to go into any anti-religion stuff here too, but I mean, to me, it's like, that's like so important, to your own well-being, that's the kind of thing I would say, do that, put your Bibles aside, put your stuff aside here. I mean, go to that stuff later, okay? Try to get yourself together.
Exactly. Do your own work. Figure yourself out.
Because you don't want to, all that other stuff, and I mean all that other stuff, I'm not just talking about, you know, the Bible, anything else that has to do with any dogma, all that stuff is going to just be like a curtain that you could put in front of all the things that you should know and all the action that's going on stage if the curtain were closed. Imagine watching a play with the curtain closed. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Shouldn't you know? It's because don't people use so many things as excuses for not facing the stuff that's behind the curtain, right?
Exactly. So my whole goal is to create a program that makes it easier for people to look behind the curtain and less frightening, you know, to kind of guide people through it. So it's,
I love that idea, and you are the person to do it any possible way I can contribute. I now officially and publicly a volunteer. Please let me know.
Oh, maybe you could be one of my test subjects.
You're going to need a lot of paper. You need a lot of paper for that. If you'd like to, I would. I'll volunteer at all. I'm not going to sit here and say I figured out everything. I haven't. But I certainly am, I'm more accepting of a self that I'm not really crazy about. I mean, I don't know, you know, if this stuff ever really ends. I just don't know. Development never really ends. You know, there's this great line in a poem somewhere where, God comes to Earth or whatever. God comes to Earth and personified, and everything is all wonderful. I mean, God's got to leave. And he goes, I got to get going because – creation is never done. The idea of like, what do you think? You're the only, people here in this eternity. I gotta, every day there's more creation going on out. There's more things going on out there. And so we'll never really get to the total bottom of it, which is why I don't believe in closure and why I do believe in mourning. But that ability to be able to tolerate it at those important moments, I think that's what it's all about.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, and once you understand what you're about, you understand what are those hidden things that motivate me and that spark my emotions. As soon as you understand it and see it, you suddenly have some control over it.
Yeah, and the thing is that you don't always like it. That's what I've discovered.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to deal with a lot of things about myself. I know people don't like things about me, but I don't think it has anything to do with the things I don't like about me, and I have to accept, because no matter what I do, that's what I do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It stinks. And I think to be able to say it stinks and to be able to say I'm uncomfortable with it and to be able to say all that stuff and have, and just the fact that I deal with it and don't go out of my mind, of course I did, I did have a nervous breakdown once, but I learned from that how, you know, the stress of all this, of all of it, it's just not worth it. But, and so we're all going to be in that spot one way or another, hopefully. I mean, a lot of people won't be, like I said before, but if we're lucky enough to be in that spot where we are, the day of reckoning is around the corner, and we do have people, loved ones, whoever they might be, you know, with us, I think it would be nice if we have any cognizance at all to be able to appreciate and go through that.
Yeah. Well, I loved it when you said that your mom, when she faced her mortality, that's when she had the recognition and apologized mm-hmm. to you mm-hmm. for filling you with fears. And that was the point of me writing What Really Matters, was to tell people, to get people to face their mortality, because that is what happens to us. Mm-hmm. Once we wake up and recognize, like, I'm not going to be here forever. Then we can start to see ourselves and start to work through these things to get things in order and get ourselves aligned inside. And so that was really profound that your mom said that to you.
Yeah, I think she like I said, she was in touch with, she might have been in touch with something she didn't understand. She obviously didn't understand before that, but, and I'm assuming, again, she didn't say to me, it's my mortality. I just assumed that now that she was facing this thing, you know, my father was already dead. And, I mean, she all this stuff, but that she was facing it herself is still different. People all dying around you, that's one thing. Because, you know, there was an, I don't know if you ever heard this, and I don't even know if it's true, but they used to tell me this about funerals, that there was, someone did research a long time ago. You know, I grew up in an Italian family. Wakes are just, you know, they're like Christmas celebrations. So you have wakes.
Yeah.
You know, it's this whole thing that you have to do. Someone said to me at a wake once, they said, you know, there was a study done that the first, anybody who walks into the room where there's a wake and bodies are there because they display, you know, the showings. Yeah. Anybody who walks in there, there's only the first thing that comes to anybody's mind, whether you know them, don't know them, whether they're your father's, doesn't matter, is, boy, I'm glad that's not me. I believe that because I went like, wow, there is a almost intrinsic clinging to life that people do. They might not even know it half the time. And if they knew about that, I go for that kind of stuff because I'm the kind of guy who wants to go kicking and screaming. I don't want it to happen, even though I don't even believe anything's going to happen. You know what I mean? I so enjoy consciousness. It bothers me. I don't even like to go to sleep sometimes. You know? I mean, it's like, as miserable as things get, I just had a great review of one of my books over in France. And this is the thing I love the most. The reviewer said, the more heartbreak that Frank writes about, the more humorous he becomes. And so it's like this relationship I have with how bad it all actually can be. And yet I just don't want to let go. That's an amazing, stupid maybe, but amazing. Huh?
No, I don't think so. I think that's kind of the essence of it, because you're fully facing the suffering and the misery that's there, but you're loving it anyway, you know? And that's a beautiful thing. I think that's one of the best things we can say about life.
Maybe. And for you to say that, and it's coming out of and that's coming as a reflection of what I said, is flattering beyond belief, because I'm stupid. We all know that. My dad knew it. Everyone, what are you, stupid?
No, I don't think so.
So look, we're gonna stay in touch, and you're going to continue to tell. You'll be on again, and you'll tell us, and you'll be in touch with me any way I can help you with the project, and we'll promote it and do whatever you got to do. Books, certainly this thing. I think this is a primary thing. I think you really got to get to work on this.
Yeah, I am working on it, and anyone who wants to know, if people go to my website and sign up for my newsletter,
yes, that, do that.
That's how I'm going to be notifying people as soon as it's ready.
And it is drkarenwyatt.com, correct?
It's karenwyattmd.com.
Right. Karen, yeah. If you Karen go to Wyatt. karenwyattmd.com, if you go to the Total Chronicles blogspot.com, there's a link right to it. There's a link to that, and there's a link to the book, What Really Matters. I encourage everyone to get it, buy it, and read it, and then get another copy and buy it for a friend or whatever, and do that. And I'm glad we worked it out. And let me just say, I'm terribly sorry. I really have to give you my condolences. I didn't even say that, and that's terrible of me. It's rude and what have you, but I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. And I knew that.
Again, but it's still important to say things like that, and certainly under these circumstances. I will be in touch. I certainly appreciate your staying as a part of our long table of intelligent people who tolerate me and are able to bring some enlightenment to an audience that for some reason or another continues to grow. I don't know why, but we're just having a great time. And we'll be in touch, and you'll be on again, right?
Thanks. Yes, Frank, it's my pleasure. I enjoy these conversations. Thanks so much.
You are quite welcome. Good night for now, and we'll see you, Dr. Karen White. Everybody knows where to go. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Doc.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. How do we turn her off? Yeah, I think I gotta like this. Where is it again now? There it is. Beep, I was waiting for that. Beep, there you go. My name is Frank Atoll. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of this show. And this show, I'm gonna put myself away on Skype. Hey, Leon, you want to get me on Skype? You can. What am I on Skype? I'm Frank Atoll. Yeah, there's no Frank Dot Catolo. But if you were just searching for somebody, you put in their name, you don't put in the dot, you get there. I'm Frank Atoll at Facebook, where you can join me? Why, join you? Why? You're coming apart? Join me. Be my friend. Come ask to be my friend. Request. I will, as long as you're of age, I will allow that. Although I have a couple of friends there, friends of friends who aren't. But you know what I mean. We don't do anything untowards, which is a word I don't even like, but I use it. Well, we do everything pretty well, well set over there. Many of the stations that carry this show continue to carry this show throughout the week. Don't worry, twice a day at True Talk Radio. So get over there. Go to Dave's Radio and to Infinity Radio and to that old Jiggy Jaguar guy. I'm going to be on his show again. Boy, there's a half hour of my life I'll never get back. I joke, but you know why not? Go get a license to Skill at Amazon. Go get blurb.com. Get Molotov Memoirs. And be aware that I'm working on it. I'm working on M3. That's some more Molotov Memoirs. And if we could even get Stephen Gessick to do more. Oh, my goodness. That'll be incredible to have Stephen Gessick do more artwork. That alone is worth the book Molotov Memoirs. So go on over and get that. In the meantime, in between time, as I said, we'll be back again. You can listen to this show, and I encourage you to do. Certainly re-listen to it. Dr. Karen Wyatt, thank you so much again for being here. I don't know what's going to happen next week as we enter into April, but we will be entering into April and having a good time doing that too. That's right, it's later than you think. So wake up, it is night. That's exactly what we mean. Thank you, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and everybody else who's listening out there, all affiliate stations. And I don't know what to say other than, if you're in Passover, have a happy Passover as it continues, and have a happy Easter, and do whatever it is you want to do. My name is Frank Atoll. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show. I hope to be back next week live at SRN Media Works. and then through all the other stations that do it. Good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you are. I'm leaving you now. I have nothing more to say.